Welcome to Civil Defense Radio with your host, Preston Schlankhofer, where we talk about all things civil defense. Civil defense is about building community resiliency by becoming better informed, prepared, and organized to meet whatever disaster might affect you, your neighborhood, and your community. There are many threats on the horizon, yet we cannot rely on true and accurate media coverage of many of these issues. These threats are propagated from the mainstream media seeking to tell only one side of the story. In fact, this propagation can even be considered biased propaganda. This is a legitimate threat to you, your family, and our nation, and here on Civil Defense Radio, we seek the facts that others leave out. Remember, your tomorrow may depend on today's preparedness. Now, here is your host, Preston Schlankhofer.
Hello, this is Preston Schlankhofer. Welcome to Civil Defense Radio. This week we have a new guest in the realm of civil defense. He's a new friend and also an associate with the EMP Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He is Caleb Retzer. He's a millennial and he's working on his master's degree in emergency management and homeland security. So if any of you emergency managers out there have any connections, Caleb's looking for work. So let's get to it. Caleb, welcome to Civil Defense Radio.
Thank you very much, Preston. I'm really happy to be here.
Yes, it's great having you. We haven't known each other long. You're a new member of the task force. And it was a pleasure getting to know you here in the first few weeks, and I look forward to seeing you and your participation with task force grow and some of your ideas and your perspective from the millennial generation of all these things that we like to talk about, especially on this show.
Yeah, been following Dr. Pratt's work for a long time, and ever since I reached out, the reception has been, you know, very welcoming, especially after our initial conversations. I feel that it's a great organization to be a part of, and you guys are doing a lot of good work, and I'm really happy to be able to contribute.
Great.
At all.
Yeah. Other than what I used as my intro, you want to add anything as far as your background, what led you to this subject, and which we'll get into here in a little bit. I guess I should give an idea. We're going to be talking about developing continuity of community after COVID and the riots that we've seen around our nation. Can you give us a little background?
Yeah, absolutely. I was born in a very small village, we'll call it, Wilcox, Pennsylvania, proud Pennsylvanian. I grew up living that, you know, sought after adventurous life that a lot of, you know, backwoods boys wanted to have. Got to experience the concept of freedom that we all kind of strive to understand. And growing up on the road, I don't exactly know how to explain it, but I was able to kind of see the thin veneer of society, kind of see how it all enveloped around this very fragile machine. And of course, when I witnessed 9/11 when I was in sixth grade, that kind of brought a lot of things home. And yeah. Then a few years after that, we, you know, saw Katrina. And that kind of shed the light, the fact that, you know, you can prepare, and especially, you know, you can trust the government to, you know, be there to protect you. And after I kind of saw how well those situations, you know, developed, or how much we were caught off guard, it really drove home the point that, you know, being prepared is more than a governmental function. And that kind of made me dive into the concept of, you know, community-based resiliency. Or at least that kind of is what, you know, brought the topic into my periphery.
Right.
Because I was still very young, still thinking about a lot of other things, but I still kept that in mind. And, you know, I grew up 2014. I decided to go to school. I tried school a few times. It didn't really, you know, take too well. But then I had the idea, hey, why don't I go to school for, you know, political science, homeland security, really kind of dive into this stuff that I've been paying attention to the entire time, right?
Uh-huh.
So I went, I got my bachelor's in political science with a minor in homeland security. And during that time is when I really settled into like the intelligence process and counterterrorism. And that's around the time that I learned about the EMP issue. And, you know, like a lot of people who initially come into contact with this topic, they have a lot of questions.
Right.
And I did not shy away from digging into it as much as I could. And yeah, turns out that is a very serious issue and enough to inspire me to then, after I got my bachelor's, to pursue my master's in emergency management. Fast forward 2 years and here I am today.
Well, that's good. And how close are you to finishing your master's?
Well, hopefully by this time next fall, it will be my last semester. So,
okay.
I'm shooting for a graduation of, yeah, next year, next fall.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you'll have an opportunity to finish without any more disruption to that education.
Yeah. Seems like a little bit of a rocky road, but I'm optimistic.
Right.
Well, got to tell you, Preston, things are looking a little sporty. So I think everyone would do well to really pay attention these next few months.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree. You know, I've said it before, COVID is one of those things that if you weren't a prepper before, you should be afterwards, because it is one of those things that is just like Katrina and 9/11 and some of these other major disasters when you're young. This will have a lasting effect on generations for a long, long time. And I think that there's a lot of people that are waking up, at least in my family, who, you know, family members who thought I was crazy, you know, they're now I wouldn't say full-blown preppers, but they have a lot more food in their pantries and in their freezers and things. Matter of fact, I got a call not too long ago from one of our good friends in a community up the road from us, and they were asking, "Hey, you know, can you help us with this food storage thing?" You know, I said, "Well, sure, let's talk about it." So, you know, we talked about it, and I referred them to some great websites and some of my past episodes. So, yeah, there's a lot of information out there, and we've got a lot of it here. We're not the experts, but I get the experts on the show. And, you know, with your work that you've done in your master's program, you know, and you have a website, and we'll put the link to that in the show notes for anybody who wants to take a look. And you've got some very good articles there and some very interesting topics. And, you know, just one of them I'm looking at right now is a critical environmental balance, the threat of nuclear meltdown caused by terrorism. That's a real threat. Weaponization of space, a threat analysis. And one that really inspired me to have you on the show is this paper you did in, what was it, 2018, called Local and State Level Consequences of a National Power Grid Failure. That's one that we're going to dig into here. And because I think you really came up with some sound advice for local and state governments and what they should really be doing. And it actually falls in line with some of the things that I've been talking about. And I wrote in my guide that people can find at the top of the resources page of our website at civildefenseradio.com. And so can you give us a little background on this paper that you wrote about the local and state level consequences?
Yeah, sure. Well, whenever I, you know, had the idea to write it, it kind of got me thinking of, okay, in the vacuum of federal authority, say if the grid did go down, you know, what would your local government do? What would your state do? And that kind of made me really evaluate the not only the emergency management system, but also the level of impact that those state and local level capabilities would have. You know, I really wanted to kind of set in stone the fact that, okay, you know, and from the perspective of a local emergency manager, the way our system is set up, as far as, you know, funding and all that goes, you know, we get the federal funding and all that. So a lot of the attention of these localities is outward.
Right. Right.
And there's a very loosely fit vacuum of attention on their own local communities. So that got me thinking, okay, well, how could we best bolster the capabilities or at least the foresight of these localities? And, you know, I did some pretty vigorous research and tried to put myself in those shoes as much as possible and kind of just brainstorm the immediate effects of that kind of situation. And, you know, it's not always effective to speculate on the periphery of an event. So what I wanted to do was just kind of get an action plan as to how you can handle the immediate effect of that, the short-term effect of that, and right. Give yourself kind of, you know, some breathing room, so to speak.
Yeah.
A way to kind of get ahead of the initial brunt of an event and go from there as far as planning and all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, Puerto Rico had a major hit a couple years ago, I guess it's 3 years ago now, when Maria hit them and just about decimated the island. And, you know, it's a case study in many aspects of preparedness. And, you know, you can look at it from a catastrophic disaster, community organizing, decentralization of systems like the microgrids, and increasing self-reliance and alternative power sources. So it's a way, you know, we shouldn't let these lessons learned and that are being learned now because of these events go by the wayside. We should learn from them, utilize these lessons that other people are learning, and then institute these policies and ideas that others are working on. Just like Houston after Harvey hit.
Absolutely. And one of the lessons that I took away from, you know, Puerto Rico kind of getting bombarded the past few years is not only decentralization of physical assets, but bureaucratic assets as well. We've seen time and time again mismanagement of funds and resources.
Oh yeah.
You know, that is being taken away from the citizenry.
Yeah. And it's being politicized.
Oh, hugely, hugely. Yeah. And, you know, those folks are being left in the dark in more than one way. And a lot of that has to do with this mistrust of, or rather misplaced trust in the authorities to be able to take care of you if one of these situations occur.
Right.
You know, it's not that the aid didn't get there. It was just ridiculously mismanaged. And a lot of people didn't get what they needed as they were promised.
Yeah.
Which kind of brings home the point of, you know, community-based civil defense and the need for robust resiliency at the community level. Because, you know, I'm sure we can speculate, but I'm sure those folks would have been a lot more well off if there was some community-based structure that they could have implemented and, you know, came together to help each other out. No, and again, that was a wake-up call for a lot of the people down in Puerto Rico, too.
Yes, it was.
But it's an excellent case study for us to learn from.
Yes.
You know, it kind of adds a level. I believe we can call it the wow factor. You know, given that Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory, you would think that, you know, by the snap of a finger, we could have had all the aid down there that they needed. We would have had their grid back up in no time, right? But it just shows how vulnerable, you know, these communities are, even on that scale.
Yes.
So it really brings home the emphasis on, you know, a more individualized and community-based level of not only preparedness, but response.
Yes. What you said earlier about the community government, you know, whether it's city, county, or state, a lot of times they look at, you know, they are the government, they are the ones who get to save everybody, and non-professionals need not apply. And, you know, FEMA's got a good program out there. It's the CERT, the Community Emergency Response Teams. And I can't remember the number of teams that are out there, but they're relatively small compared to what they should be. Matter of fact, the county that I live in doesn't even have one, and he doesn't want one. The emergency manager told me, I don't want one. I don't like that program. Well, you know, I asked him, what is he like? And he doesn't have an idea, which means that he doesn't want non-professionals messing in the soup. So
yeah,
that's a problem. Part of the problem we have in our country is this old idea of emergency management that, you know, we're the government, you know, we're here to take care of you. Well, like you've mentioned, it doesn't work very well. The government does a bad job of taking care of things. Matter of fact, they rely too much on community mutual aid assistance agreements with other jurisdictions,
yes,
other cities and counties. Oh, you know, if we get in trouble, then these guys are going to come help us. Well, that leaves their community at risk because their people are over here. What about going to the human factor in your own community and saying, hey, you know, we need your help, Joe Q citizen, you know, step up and be part of our organization that helps locally. And, you know, there's a lot of patriotic and community aware citizens who want to help out. They just need a platform to do that. And I think a grassroots community-based civil defense organization is the way to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure you can agree with me, but a lot of people would be very surprised to find out that even in FEMA's mission statement and their, you know, standard protocols is that they are explicitly supposed to take on a supportive role. They're supposed to support the localities, the, you know, state and tribal governments, right? That people don't understand that they're there, or at least supposed to be there, to take on a strictly supportive role.
Yeah.
Yet the entire populace sees them as, you know, their savior.
Yeah. And they're the big daddy government.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's a very dangerous mindset to have.
Yeah.
When you don't even understand that, you know, hey, I'm supposed to be in charge of our own preparedness. You're just, you know, kind of, you know, shoving it off onto someone else's responsibility, and then you get what you get.
Yeah.
You know, their results, a lot of times they kind of speak for themselves, and that is a mere reflection of the mentality that a large portion of the populace has. And that's an unfortunate thing.
Yeah.
However, you know, we got a huge portion of it, a huge portion of the population that are, you know, extremely willing to take preparedness seriously and take preparedness into their own hands and work with the community to increase their resiliency. And that's a really awesome thing to see when you see it.
Yes. Yes. Now, in your paper, Local and State Level Consequences of National Power Grid Failure, the paper starts out being about a power grid blackout. But this could be any type of situation where you have a severe disaster in your community. And it's something that too many people fall short of when they really think about their threat matrix. But in here, you talk, one of your subtitles in the paper here is local and state consequences. And you really start getting into the nuts and bolts of the local issues. Let me just read a couple excerpts here. I guess I should go back to the beginning of that paragraph. It says, there are various peripheral aspects to consider when discussing the effects of a grid down scenario. The pressure will be high, given that the responsibility of accountability will be at the forefront of the concern of many officials. This scenario would not be easy to manage, and the necessities and demands of the citizens will be high. And that is very true, especially in the spoiled immediate gratification environment that we're in now. Mechanisms that sustain modern government channels will be strained to the brink, and an environment that can facilitate contention and discontent will be the setting that officials on all levels of government will have to face. That's true. There will be a lot of ticked off people if they don't get help. And the best way to get help is to mobilize your local citizens.
Yeah, I'm almost taken back every time I think of the situation unfolding. Again, the thing about emergency planning is that nobody wants to talk about it until after they need it, right?
Yeah.
And, you know,
you're behind the power curve at that point.
Yeah. And even, you know, if I'm looking at it from a social perspective, even from the time that I wrote this paper to now, the dynamics of the, you know, the social aspects have completely changed and they've become a lot more volatile.
Oh, yeah.
Even considering the possibility in today's social environment, you already have people that are at each other's throat.
Yeah.
Constantly.
Yeah.
So to couple that with, you know, being a local official or, you know, emergency manager and having to referee that during a crisis, as well as, you know, maintain that level of accountability that the citizens are expecting, that it's a Herculean effort to consider unless you have the mechanisms in place to really galvanize your community and kind of stem off those negative peripheral consequences that we're talking about.
Yeah, and that must be done prior to, because disasters are come as you are events, as a friend of mine said.
Yes.
It's not something that you want to try and organize after the fact. Sure, those people in Houston did a good job, but they weren't necessarily organized after Hurricane Harvey hit them. They just started responding and they ended up responding in large enough numbers that they helped save a lot of people. But
yeah,
that doesn't always turn out that way. There needs to be training, there needs to be organization, and there needs to be some way of bringing these people together. So going on further with your paper here, response time for the federal government responding to a concentrated effort may be longer still. This would put a much higher demand on local and state authorities to provide order and relief due to federal government's inability to do so on a scale that provides for the specific needs that will surely be appropriate for each level of government and the distinct locations the other levels of government oversee. A delay in the arrival of relief is to be expected. One aspect that is rather worrisome is the breakdown of social order that is heavily anticipated in a prolonged event. The 2008 report by the Congressional EMP Commission suggested that within 12 to 18 months of a national grid down event, there would be anywhere from 75 to 95% of the population would be dead based on lack of food, poor water, civil unrest. That would be a very, very severe environment to try and manage anything in.
Absolutely. And I don't know about you, but I would feel much more comfortable, at least, you know, from the perspective of my community, to, you know, have some sort of mechanisms in place that we can actually become a rather self-sufficient enclave, if you will, if social order breaks down. You know, conceptually, on a town-to-town level, that's not really a far-fetched thing to consider.
Right.
And the only issue is seeing if your community can understand the potentiality of it.
Yeah.
You know, the federal government, if a EMP or CME or, you know, any large scale disaster hits, now getting the relief there, it's a huge logistical effort. Logistic chains are very fragile.
Yeah.
Now, you know, you got the relief stemming from one entity, you know, in this example, it would be the federal government. Their capabilities are going to be stretched extremely thin.
Yes.
And at best, at best, you know, they would have a, you know, we can call it a universal package of relief. Now, you know, effective relief depends, you know, on the understanding of local demographics, the terrain, the geographic implications, a whole set of specialized demands. And if a large scale event like this was to take place, I believe the federal government or even the state government would be very hard pressed to actually fulfill the needs that the demand would be pressing on. What you get after that, after, you know, the, we'll call them hiccups in the aid delivery or the response, that's when we see social order breakdown. And that, you know, at least I would anticipate would happen relatively quick after an event like this. I'm sure you're familiar with the saying, we're only 9 meals away from anarchy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, when people are scared, when people are disorganized and don't know what to do, a large part, by and large, you know, they'll always do the selfish thing.
Yeah. And we saw this in the beginning of this COVID thing, too. There's been a lot of selfish people out there. Matter of fact, in California and Oregon, in a couple small mountain communities, there were women whose grocery carts were stolen in the parking lot, a couple of them at gunpoint.
Yeah. Perfect example right there.
Yeah. And we were just a couple weeks into this.
Yeah. I remember when all this happened, I was, you know, me and my family, we were very apprehensive about going to the grocery store because, you know, we understand people freak out. And, you know, again, when people are scared, they do very stupid things, like steal grocery carts at gunpoint. I don't know if you were, maybe you are familiar with the, you know, the special COVID event with the toilet paper. Are you aware of that?
Oh yeah,
like that kind of blew my mind. And but again, that you know, kind of shows where people's heads are at during a crisis.
Yeah, well, they're not using them.
Yeah, no, their reasoning is very sporadic.
Yeah, it can spiral out of control very quickly, especially, like I said, we have a lot of selfishness within us, and in certain environments and stimulus can bring that out in many, many ways. And it's not very advantageous to a civil society. But no, we're going to have to cut it off. So, Caleb, I appreciate you being on the show. It was fun talking with you about this subject. And we'll talk more in the next weeks and months to come. Some of our predictions that we talked about before the show, we'll see if they come true. You know, I just want to give our friends out there that are listening to us right now a heads up. You have a short window to be prepared for some heavy stuff that's coming. I'm not going to talk about it right now. I may do a show specifically on this, but right now what I'm saying is get ready. Be prepared, because there's some heavy stuff coming, and you don't want to be left behind. Start organizing, get with friends and relatives, and create those enclaves. You know, you can have a civil defense organization within your community. Let's say you have a specific gated community or a small town that's kind of rural. That is your community. That is your enclave. That is where you and yours get together with other people to survive in austere environments. And we may be looking at some of that. So just be warned, be prepared. There's a possibility. I'm not saying that it's going to happen, but I'm saying there's a possibility, because there's some heavy threats out there. So civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problems has failed us. We need a community-based grassroots approach to solve this problem. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training to meet the needs of whatever situation we may find ourselves in. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and this is why we strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. Let's start a conversation with the guide found on our resources page at civildefenseradio.com. It's right at the top of the page. Be sure to check out our regular postings on Facebook at Civil Defense Radio and on Twitter at civil_DEF_radio. And our YouTube channel, which is Civil Defense Radio Podcast. And I wish to thank Caleb again for being on the show. And I also wish to thank you, our friends, who are listening to us on a regular basis, especially you guys that are from other countries. We really appreciate our international audience. And everybody who listens, we're very, very appreciative. This is a work of love. It's at our expense, and this is something that we feel, my wife and I, needs to be out there. So please, be safe, be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you and keep you until next time.